KZSU, Stanford University. My name is Dave Levine, and welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, a show designed to discuss both technology, law, policy issues without actually forcing you to become a lawyer to understand it. I am a resident director, wow, that's going back to my days as a law student when I was a resident director of a dorm. Now, I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and thanks for listening today. Today's topic of discussion moves us into the realm of politics squarely and also into the realm of economics, an area which we haven't explored too much except in the context of intellectual property with previous guests like David Olson and Professor Demers from USC. But today's discussion is revolving around issues of deficit reduction, that is the federal deficit, as well as debt reduction and related issues. And I'm pleased today to have with us in a few minutes Corey Davison, who's the Legislative Affairs Director of the Concord Coalition. I'll allow Corey a much greater opportunity to expand on what Concord Coalition is. Suffice to say, it's an organization that was founded by the late Senator Paul Tsongas from Massachusetts and Warren Rudman from New Hampshire in the early 90s, right around the time that Senator Tsongas was running for president. And the organization's main focus has been to address the spiraling out of control world of federal budget issues, specifically reducing the federal debt and reducing the yearly deficit. The focus today will not be on the economics or the particular issue as much as it will be revolving around issues of policy and policy advocacy inside the Beltway in connection with technology. And Corey, who has extensive experience in Washington as well as with Concord Coalition, is a terrific person to really bring us up to speed on what's happening there. By way of disclosure, I should reveal that I have been involved with Concord Coalition almost since its inception. I'm a huge supporter of it. And if I wasn't doing a show on technology, I might attempt to do a show on economics and deficit issues, although I think the listenership would probably decrease quickly, as there are exceptionally difficult issues to address, notwithstanding their prime importance. But I was involved with Concord Coalition when I was an undergrad at Cornell University and founded a chapter there. I later on, after I graduated from Cornell, I volunteered as the field director in New York State in the mid-90s. After that, I went in and out as I focused on my career and on law school, but I spoke on occasion. I was involved more recently in New York trying to get some stuff going there, and I'm here now. So it's certainly this interview for anyone that's listening and wondering what if I have any particular interest here. Well, I'm pretty much squarely in the same camp as Concord Coalition, and really kind of in a shocking way in terms of the amount of issues upon which I agree. So let's go into a short music break. That was, by the way, Dire Straits and Setting Me Up. Let's take a short music break, and then we come back. Let's talk to Corey Davison. So if all has gone well, and I hope it has, Corey Davison is on the other end. Corey, are you there?
I am.
Terrific. Terrific. Well, thank you for being on today. I appreciate it. Why don't we start off right now and just kind of give a little better introduction, not only to you, but to Concord Coalition. So maybe fill everyone in on who you are and what brought you to Concord and what Concord's all about.
Well, that sounds great. Your music kind of brought me back to my high school years. We've got quite a bit of feedback right now.
Actually, yeah, what's going on there? Hold on a second.
Okay.
Let's try that again. Are you there?
I am.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. That's sounding much better. The Concord Coalition was formed, as you mentioned, in 1992. It was formed by the late Senator Paul Tsongas not long after he dropped out of the presidential race, and former Republican Senator Warren Rudman. And 1992 was a pretty interesting time in our nation's history that I think relates quite a bit to today's climate. We had a brutal amount of partisanship on Capitol Hill and across the country. We had budget deficits, which seemed to be like they'd have no end in sight. And a bunch of people were getting angrier and angrier about it, and they wanted to have some kind of a venue that might be constructive. And so the Concord Coalition was formed. I had been on Capitol Hill starting in 1990, and I got my internship on Capitol Hill because I played baseball for the same college as the congressman who picked me up.
Sounds like a good Washington story right there.
That was my in, that's right. And so other than throwing batting practice for some congressional baseball teams over the years, the Democrats lost in a drubbing this year to the Republicans again. It's been a long Republican domination of the Democrats in that baseball game for the last several years. But in 1990, my first month on Capitol Hill, we had a government shutdown due to the budget stalemate in 1990. That was the year that President Bush had to go back on his "Read My Lips, No New Taxes" pledge. And we also had Saddam Hussein and Iraq invading Kuwait. And so you look at my first couple of months on Capitol Hill, and a lot of it has related to international affairs with what's going on with Iraq, and a lot of it's been related to the budget and budget shutdowns and budget deficits and some of the challenges we faced. And so I was on the Hill about 2 years when the Concord Coalition was formed, and by that point, 2 years on Capitol Hill kind of makes us a grizzled veteran, which is, I guess a joke, a sad joke.
But, to say, I think it's the same in state government where I was.
I think so. But I realized that the federal budget and the books just didn't really add up in the long term, even though we can budget with a deficit from year to year, and the national debt can be, $4 trillion as it was back then, or $8.4 trillion as it is today. At some point or another, something has to give. Somebody has to pay.
Let me stop right there, because
sure.
That number is always so shocking. What, $8.4 trillion is just how much growth are we talking about just within the last, 10 years, 15 years? These numbers always startled me, and I always struggled at how to describe what $8.4 trillion looks like. But what's the current way that Concord is describing these numbers?
Well, it comes down to, if you broke down the national debt per man, woman, and child, and this is one of the things we've done for years, it's roughly $30,000 per man, woman, and child.
That's incredible.
And so that's incredible. It's an $8.4 trillion national debt. That includes all of the deficits that we've had, and it also includes what we've borrowed from Social Security, which at this point is getting to be a pretty sizable amount of money. If anybody remembers Al Gore being made fun of for talking about his lockbox on Saturday Night Live, we have certainly not locked away Social Security surpluses, and we're borrowing those, and we will be for the foreseeable future. So the Concord Coalition is concerned in a given year, about trying to balance the budget. We're going to have a budget deficit this year of roughly $300 billion. And to put that into context, the entire national economy, our GDP, is $11 or $12 trillion, right in that range. And the federal government takes in about $2.3 trillion in taxes. And so it plays a huge role in terms of our pocketbooks and in terms of the entire national economy.
It's a crowding out effect. Am I right about that?
Well, I think so. At some point, we'll take in $2.3 trillion and then we'll spend about $300 billion above and beyond that. That doesn't even include what we'll borrow from Social Security, which at this point is on paper, but in not too many years, as the baby boom generation retires, that will go from a paper transfer to where we'll have to come up with general income revenue to pay back the Social Security Trust Fund. So those are the kinds of things that we talk about a little bit in the technical sense. But what really got me involved in the Concord Coalition was the concept that there was a good chance that my son or daughter, sometime down the road, were going to inherit an even worse future than what may happen when I'm in my 50s, 60s, and 70s. And now that's a very real thing for me, because I have a son who's 14 months old, and I'm very optimistic about his future. I think he's going to have all kinds of opportunities, and he'll see things that I, don't even fathom today. But I do believe that he will have to, carry through the taxes that he pays and through his life a pretty sizable debt burden that will limit some of his opportunities. And I feel bad about that, but I also feel like I'm doing something about it by being on Concord Coalition staff.
And with in that connection, it's such a huge number, and 30,000 a person, and the moral imperative. Before we touch on the technology, but I think it's a good segue into it, and again getting into those details. That going back to the inception of Concord Coalition, where you were involved on the Hill, and I was involved volunteering. from the very beginning, there was a whole issue of what people deemed to be generational warfare. In other words, that by this, and you know what this is, but by, for the benefit of listeners, by discussing these issues and putting it in terms of grandchildren versus the current generation, what have you, you somehow were encouraging warfare, that is, in the social sense, not in the literal sense, between the World War II generation at the time and baby boomers versus Generation X and Generation Y or whatever people are called now. It kind of moves us into technology issues because technology is, I believe, changing the terrain. But maybe you could talk a little bit about that issue as a segue into how technology intersects with these issues.
That's right. One of the easy things we could have done to get more members early on or to get more media attention would have been to play the, it's all the old people's fault and let's take away their benefits so us, Generation X and Generation Y and future generations can benefit. And we realized pretty quickly that politically that's just not going to happen. AARP's membership will always outnumber a group like the Concord Coalition, so in some ways it's not politically feasible. But the way I like to think of it, too, is that we are a Concord Coalition membership that is nonpartisan in nature. Our members are pretty evenly split. About a third are Republican, a third are Democrat, and a third are other. But they're also very split in ages. We have a number of elderly Concord Coalition members. And when we talk about the issues, I think it's important to talk about how this generation is likely going to fail kids that are just 12, 14 months old right now. But at the same time, we need the nation's seniors to be involved in the kind of legacy they leave for their kids. And so, for the baby boomers, that means talking about reforming Social Security and Medicare as they're just preparing to go in. And then when you talk about the technology, it's an amazing thing to think about an organization that's relatively new. We were formed in 1992, but our methods have changed entirely since our founding. We've had a website for less than 10 years. I've really started to do a lot of the grassroots organizing within the last 6 years or so. And so, we think we're doing some things pretty well, and we think we have an awful lot to learn in other ways.
The technology is a challenging issue for so many organizations. And by way of example, going back, 10 years ago or so when I was, or more than 10 years now, as I continue to shock myself at my current age, I would go and give speeches to AARP chapters where one would expect that, as you're describing, that there would be this reaction of, you're just trying to take money out of our pockets and we can't live. And what always impressed me about Concord Coalition, aside from the bipartisanship, which was one reason to be involved for me, was that Concord really was prescribing solutions that did not go into political analyses of what was important and what wasn't important as much as to say that everyone's going to have to chip in. And I think what would have helped me, and kind of turning into technology, is at the time, we're talking in the 1995 or so, you didn't have the kind of easy access to PowerPoint or the Mac versions or any of the other means by which one can really demonstrate graphically what's happening. Turning into technology, with things like that, whether it be a blog or whether it be PowerPoint type media, how is technology helping or in fact hindering describing an issue like the debt, which is so incredibly difficult to quantify, so incredibly difficult to explain, and even more difficult at times to explain how it impacts the average person?
Well, I think it helps more than it hinders, but it does a little bit of both. I think the current era of discussing budgeting and fiscal responsibility really started about somewhere around 1990 or 1992. One of the first people who used budget talks effectively or chart talks effectively was Ross Perot in his bid for the presidency. And he would take two or three charts describing the economic situation and make a point that was very easy to understand for everybody. And he really was able to get a pretty large group of supporters until he dropped out and came back in and dropped out again. I mean, his numbers were pretty good in that presidential race. And he was using charts pretty effectively as he ran for president. With the use now of PowerPoint presentations and of charts, obviously we can give a 100 chart talk to a civic club or to a university. We're going to put them to sleep pretty quickly. And so in some ways, it's still the bread and butter issue of what matters. What we talk about are the priorities of what are our economic challenges and the budget deficit challenges. our kids. I was mentioning the debt is $30,000 per man, woman, and child in this country if you broke it down per capita. Our unfunded obligations per household in this country are roughly $500,000.
What does that mean when you say unfunded obligation?
We have promised in Social Security, Medicare, health care, and pension benefits roughly $500,000 per household more than we've put in or than we will put in our FICA taxes unless we change the law. The law is the nuts and bolts of what the Concord Coalition talks about, and that is that there is not an easy solution. You can't just raise taxes. You can't just borrow the money to come up with benefits, and you can't just cut benefits. Any of those have tremendous political and economic ramifications, and so we try to talk about these issues in a little bit more realistic manner. And it's refreshing, but it is more complicated, and so with the use of technology, we've seen a number of blogs that have helped with the debate by talking about some of the benefits and trade-offs of potential solutions. But here's where I guess I should talk about the hindrance, and that is that since we're still in the first decade, really, of the blogosphere, so many of them become polarized. They go so far left or right or conservative or liberal that a lot of times they tend to almost polarize the policy debate more than it would have been under kind of rude political scenes anyway. And so I guess what I would hope is that we see maturization of the blogosphere, of the way people use technology, to not just talk about the easy solutions or to, you know, condemn the other party or the other politician, but that we can also have some very realistic debates from our homes rather than having to go to a town hall meeting where we can learn more about the challenges we face and what the potential solutions might be.
What blogs in particular would you recommend in terms of discussing these issues? And if you could expand a little on why those blogs work, in your opinion, better than others?
I can't even come up with a recommendation of which blogs. I read a number of blogs each day, even though I consider myself new to reading blogs right now. I read everything from the right and the left that deals with fiscal policy. And I find a real mixture of things that I find useful and things that are very condemning of solid fiscal responsibility debate. So I think without going into specifics of who I like, I've looked more at websites, and the Concord Coalition has been improving its website as the years have gone on. We are found at concordcoalition.org. We had a discussion group, which was kind of a rudimentary form of blog early on, but it would get really almost hijacked by issues that went way beyond or were not related to our issues, and so we let that go, and I guess I'd like to see us do more of that again, but we also would like to see fiscal policy brought into existing, there are so many to mention that I get none really stand out off the top of my head.
Let's focus a little bit on the operations of blogs, because they are so challenging. You have, when you're dealing with things like issue advocacy, where Concord Coalition's focus is, a particular set of issues as opposed to a general discussion of all forms of politics, you have this issue where comments can come in that move you off topic. Do you find, in at least in reading blogs generally, without getting into specifics, do you feel that the blogs themselves are encouraging the kind of discussion that is actually being noticed inside the Beltway, or are blogs really still kind of, in a certain corner of the world without having that kind of influence?
I see a bridge being built between people who are heavily involved in blogs and people who know nothing about them. I definitely think that this election cycle will see a number of candidates reach out to blogs, and a number of blogs that will influence the political process in specific congressional districts and certainly on the national scale. I think that was probably best shown by the number of Democratic presidential aspirants who participated in the national blog conference recently. I think every candidate had some kind of a person there or appeared personally. And so I think that we're seeing a real increase right now in interest, but it's really in its infancy in a number of ways. But even the major newspapers that have their own kinds of commentary that allow for a little bit of a blog, if you will, the Washington Post blog is something that I read pretty regularly. Well, that's a pretty mainstream piece, but I think there are also a number of sites and blogs that can provide information that will more steadily influence the political process.
Do you find that dealing with the technology that you find, are you finding, at least with Concord site, but generally, that people across generations are accessing this information in new ways? You know, before, again, you know, even going back 10 years ago, the internet was still in its infancy, and while I can vaguely remember accessing web pages in 96 or 97, it really, you know, wasn't the kind of medium that it is now, and people were still relying on fax machines and phone trees and newsletters that were actually mailed. And even, you know, going back to my time volunteering in New York in the mid-90s, we were actively putting together handouts that we would either mail, you know, by stuffing envelopes and putting stamps on or what have you. And now with the internet, you obviously have a greater means of communication. But the challenge, of course, always is getting people to the machines, and putting aside the social issues of actual access to technology, you know, because of the costs and what have you. Are you finding that people that, you know, perhaps even 7 or 8 years ago might not have been familiar with the technology are accessing it? Do you find that you're getting more contacts through your web page from people that wouldn't have been using it previously, or do you have any sense of that?
Oh, absolutely. It has completely changed the way that a group like the Concord Coalition, I think any other nonprofit group, any group involved in policy or politics, we operate completely in a completely different way today than we did 10 years ago. I joined the Concord Coalition in 1996, so I can say that really firsthand. What we spent our time doing 10 years ago was we would have town hall meetings that we still do today. We'd have chapter meetings where people would get together. We would have volunteer parties where people would mail packets of newspaper clips and Concord Coalition policy briefs to hundreds of people across the country. And then we would hope that they would photocopy it and send it to other people. You don't need to spend tremendous person hours and mailing costs on that kind of stuff at all now, because it's all available on our website and online. Our members, almost all of our Concord Coalition members have gone online, and when we see, you know, nationally, the percentages of people, even among seniors, continues to increase. And so the ability to get the information out has changed dramatically. We don't do the mailing parties. It's also suffered in a couple ways with the technology. It's far more beneficial than bad. On the one side, I'm able to get information out to thousands of people now compared to hundreds of people, 10 years ago. But on the negative side, I really think that people have less time now for civic activism than they did before, and part of that is due to the amount of time we spend on the technology, on our internet at home or at our workplace, and doing anything from blogging to emailing. We've changed what we do with our time a little bit, and so we think the turnout for some different events is probably down. One of the reasons the turnout might be bad is that we have such an overload of information that we're probably competing with quite a few more issues now today than we were 10 years ago. And if we don't get our information out there effectively, we're going to get trumped, and somebody will read something else. It's already an uphill battle to try to get people interested in talking about deficits and debt for an hour or half an hour. And so we have to really rethink on a regular basis, how do we make these issues relevant to people if they're 18 or if they're 80?
That's an interesting point you make about the ability for people based upon time to go to events. I wonder, though, whether the virtual town hall concept, and I know that's a cliche at this point, but whether that ultimately is mitigating that concern. 10 years ago, if you wanted to go see the debt clock, one of the famous props that Concord Coalition used, and I believe still uses, right?
That's right. In fact, we have debt badges now. Anybody who wants a debt badge can just order one from us by going to our website at ConcordCoalition.org. It ticks up that national debt in real time.
That's outstanding, and I'll be picking one up myself. That's terrific. But, the debt clock was something you had to go physically see, whereas now you could go on the internet or use the debt badge. I'm wondering whether, on the one side, not having the turnout, obviously, in the traditional media sense, does have an impact, in that you don't, if you have cameras there or reporters, they want to be able to report that X number of people showed up. And so I certainly recognize, and I wouldn't argue that that isn't a problem. But the flip side of it seems to me that if you're getting as many or more people getting the same information from the internet, then at the end of the day, it like you said, it's a net gain. Do you find that, and perhaps this will be the last question before we go into a music break, do you find that the whole event notion, the splash notion that has existed in politics since the beginning of time is changing radically with the advent of this technology?
I think it's changed. However, I still find getting together as citizens to discuss the issues, it's so important because it's easy to go into your own venue and read things you agree with already. Part of what the Concord Coalition is all about is to talk about the benefits and trade-offs and the various politics and economic theories involved. And so that's something that's hard to capture with technology, but I hope that really the blogging community can pick that up so more people are introduced to it rather than less. I think in all we have a real net gain in terms of technology's role in citizen movements and organizations like the Concord Coalition.
Well, I think that's a nice way to segue into a music break. And when we come back, I'd like to move more in that direction of how technology is impacting both mainstream candidates and third party movements. And we can discuss whether Concord Coalition is a third-party movement. That's been another question that's always I've always kicked around, and I know it's been discussed in the past. But let's go into a short music break, and when we come back, we'll pick up the discussion. Jackson Browne's These Days, and I think that last piece of lyric there, "Don't confront me with my failures, I had not forgotten them," is in many ways exactly what Concord Coalition is all about and what they do. Before we go back to Corey, I just wanted to point out, if you'd like to become a part of KZSU, you can come to our quarterly information meeting held at 7 p.m. today, Wednesday, July 5th, in the Oak Room West in Tresidder Student Union on the Stanford campus. There you can learn about volunteer opportunities in our news, sports, and music departments, our free broadcast training class, and the process of getting your very own show. For more information on the meeting, and if you're listening to this right now, you've got about an hour and a half left, but check it out on www.kzsu.org. So I'm welcoming back Corey. And Corey, I wanted to move us right into the direction of one of the curiosities of Concord Coalition. So just putting it out bluntly, is Concord Coalition the progenitor of a third party?
We get asked that pretty regularly. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so by definition, we are not a political organization. We cannot and do not endorse, support, or oppose political candidates or political parties. One thing I've noted going around the country for 10 years for the Concord Coalition, now doing events from California to Maine, is our membership has remained very evenly split. About a third are Republicans, a third are Democrat, and a third are other. And that's something I'm constantly curious about how we retain that. And I think really the answer is that our approach to budgeting and our look at fiscal responsibility is something that's a little beyond or a little different from what either political party has to say right now. We care deeply about the long term and what we're handing off to our kids. And so many of the political battles, pit both parties in different kinds of roles. Oftentimes trying to claim the mantle of fiscal responsibility, but rarely really achieving it. So third-party members, political independents, a lot of times find us to be a very good source for some tough questions on fiscal responsibility issues that they can ask their Democrat or Republican who might not be up to snuff.
So basically, it sounds like as much as some people, that third perhaps, that are not party-affiliated, would like to somehow turn Concord into the reform movement of Ross Perot's or the Unity 08 efforts that seem to be starting now, Concord Coalition is not designed to move in that direction.
Not at all. We are issue based in that we care about the budget deficits and the wasteful spending and the wasteful or irresponsible tax policies today and what they mean for our kids and our grandkids down the road. I do think that our information and approach to things like trying to ask for spending caps on spending or to bring back pay-as-you-go budgeting, some things that worked well to rein in deficits during President Reagan, President Bush 41, and President Clinton, those are things that should be considered right now. I think a third party or an independent group could take some of our tough questions and use them pretty effectively in congressional districts around the country.
Is one of the issues that's come up recently, and that's in the current events, and I want to talk a little bit about the economics before we go back to technology and kind of close on that, is the movement to eliminate the estate or death tax, as it's known as slang. What's the current state of that issue, and again, how does that impact the world of Concord Coalition and what Concord's trying to achieve?
Well, I think it's one of those interesting issues where if you poll the American public or did any kind of search about the estate tax, it's a very unpopular tax. Most people across the California and the East Coast and certainly in the Midwest, they call it a death tax, and most farmers and small business owners think that they'll be impacted, when in reality the estate tax has only impacted between 1 and 2 and 3% of the American estates for several years now. The movement in Congress was to abolish the estate tax entirely, which would be a massive windfall for estates, of $4 million and up. And we opposed that. And the reason we opposed it is we're running budget deficits right now. The likelihood that the estate tax, the loss of revenue in that, would be made up by some kind of spending cuts or tax increases was nil. And so we absolutely opposed that kind of a tax cut. Right now, across the board, our approach is if you're going to have a tax cut, you ought to pay for it. You ought to either decrease spending someplace or increase taxes elsewhere. It's how we've budgeted, especially during difficult times in our nation's history. So we wound up falling in the minority on that, though. As the estate tax was debated, they wound up coming up with some kind of a compromise, although I would not call it a good compromise, where now estates above around $5 million will be subject to an estate tax, but the rate goes down substantially. Over the first couple of years, it doesn't cost that much money, but in the long term, it costs several billion dollars that are just going to be directly going into adding up the national debt.
Do you find that the death tax, using the slang, it has always been an issue that has bothered a lot of people, and it's always been, of course, entangled with the whole issue of cutting taxes generally. We're not right now, it seems, in a mindset, clearly based upon what's happening in Congress, of merely cutting taxes, because at the same time spending is going up, which of course is the opposite direction of where we want to be. But do you find that deficit reduction issues, especially from what you've seen in the world of blogs and just communicating by means of the internet, is mired in the same blue state, red state, liberal, conservative kind of dogma that tax cuts and taxation has been for decades?
Well, I think it's changed quite a bit. We used to cut taxes and then do other kinds of things. You know, in budgeting in a household or a business, you cut taxes. You try to change around your spending and your revenue pretty regularly, and that has really changed right now to where tax cuts are entirely off the table. And I think that's a really unhealthy development. That said, I think the estate tax was one where the rhetorical warfare was very well used on the opposite side of the issue from where the Concord Coalition stands, in that the estate tax seemed to be unfair to businesses and to households, and also that it seemed like it would be this big tax increase on a bunch of Americans, when in reality the estate tax is going up only slightly, and they needed to make some small changes. Instead, it winds up being a major windfall for the wealthiest American households and businesses.
It's one of those issues, I think, and again, going back to this theme, which I've always grappled with Concord and just discussing the issue, which is the complexity of it. And I really wanted to turn now, in the remaining 10 or 12 minutes that we have, to kind of turn towards an area that I'm particularly interested in and that I'm writing about and plan to continue writing about for years to come. Once I make my transition into teaching, and that is how technology impacts secrecy efforts. Government obviously and has operated with a legitimate need in many cases for secrecy. Obviously, we're in an era right now which is perhaps even beyond Nixonian in terms of the means by which government is, and I'm speaking specifically the federal government, has attempted to maintain secrecy. But I'm wondering, from your perspective, having been involved not only in issue advocacy but working on the Hill for many years, Do you find that technology is allowing for greater sharing of information and therefore less of an ability for decision makers to keep secrets or to keep information from the public? There's been, you know, whether you go in the direction of having Congressional Research Service reports, which used to be relatively difficult to find, but now you can find on the web, meaning more access, or whether it's going back to the contract with America that Gingrich had proposed, where, among other things, he had advocated that reports and bills that were put on the floor of Congress would simultaneously be made publicly available by means of technology. Where are we now? Is obviously it's a funny question to ask given what's happening right now in terms of secrecy and what government's trying to do, but I'm wondering what your perspective is on it at this moment.
Well, I think the question couldn't be more timely. I did an hour-long radio interview in Wisconsin about a week and a half ago, and the issue of secrecy and of, you know, that politicians are hiding information from the public came up again and again and again, and I think I'm seeing a real growth in terms of the town hall meetings I'm doing and just as importantly, reading the blogs, that Americans are certainly a little more skeptical or cynical about the process and whether or not the sun is really shining in. I think we're at a crossroads when it comes to the issue of secrecy, which is why I think you're kind of on the ground floor, or a little bit of a pioneer in this area, David, because we can go one of two directions. We can either have more information available where we can learn about a lot of the consequences of spending policies and of the government's priorities in terms of spending, in terms of tax cuts, in terms of where we're headed in the long term. There are more websites and there's more information available today on fiscal policy, whether you agree with the Concord Coalition or you're more of a fan of tax cuts or you're more liberal and would fight for the spending for today. but regardless of your political ideology, there are all kinds of sites and blogs out there that can provide information. Also, it's that way with the federal government's budget. With the exception, and the very small exception, of some national security spending, most of the spending is available online, and you can find quite a bit of information. Now, that said, there has been a growing problem that goes in the opposite direction of what Speaker Gingrich talked about, and that is that in the final hours, a lot of these bills are being passed that have all kinds of new earmarks, meaning specific spending projects, attached at the midnight hour. We never learn about them until they're passed, and then pretty soon you have funding for a bridge to nowhere in Alaska and projects in all kinds of districts across the country. Not only are those oftentimes wasteful, but they are also something that was done so quickly that very few members of Congress, with the exception of the author, even knew they were in that legislation. So we can go one of two directions. We can either find out more information and use this in a healthy debate, or we can continue to quell more of that and have Congress and the process do an end run around the public's ability to find out that information.
And that seems to be from my own experience also right on point and dead on. Working in the New York State Legislature in the mid 90s, I was constantly amazed that other than the Legislative Gazette, which was an in-house newspaper that was run by college students from one of the SUNY schools. I off the top of my head, I don't remember which one. Other than the Legislative Gazette and the Albany Times Union and the City of Troy newspaper, the sister city to Albany on the other side of the Hudson, no one at all was covering what was happening in Albany. And, you know, the result was that things would go on there, good or bad. It didn't even matter what, but things would happen, and there was simply no way to find out. And my eyes were open just going up there fresh out of college, because I thought that I knew what was going on in the world of government generally, reading the newspaper and what have you. And what I discovered, of course, is that I knew virtually nothing, because decisions were being made literally behind closed doors, but certainly without you know, very much public knowledge. And, you know, eventually the outcome would manifest itself either in an article or in the actual effects of, or lack of effects of what was happening. So it's interesting to me that we have an era where at the same time technology allows for much greater access information, that there's perhaps it's logical, though, that there would be an increased effort to maintain secrecy in the face of this onslaught. But the argument that I've made in a paper that will be coming out in Florida Law Review on trade secrets and public infrastructure, and the argument that I think I want to develop even more, is that the more information that's out there, ultimately the better decisions will be rendered, and in more significantly for those that are in power, it will allow them to stay there, which the fact of the matter is, incumbency is an important factor, and people want to make careers out of being politicians, and we shouldn't discourage people from entering public service. But it seems to me that the era of secrecy is becoming increasingly more difficult, but the lack of secrecy ultimately should help us.
Well, I think the more information should help a lot. To put it in academic terms, because I'm sure you have quite a few students and people in the academic community across the country that listen to this. The blogs, the internet, they give us tools that we did not have, a decade ago, and that is a very positive development. But at the same time, we can't just rest on that and get lazy. Doing primary research and doing important, a little bit of digging on our own and our own thought. Is going to be vital in terms of the process of fighting for fiscal responsibility or for any other cause that is going on, whether it's in a state capital somewhere or in the nation's capital. And so we can't just take that hour a week, if we had that for our volunteer time, looking at federal issues and how we try to relate to our members of Congress. We can't just take that time to search the web or to go on a blog. I think it still requires that next step of rolling up our sleeves and contacting our friends and neighbors with things that we find of interest, and also writing some tough letters and some rewarding letters. Thank you for your tough vote on an issue when it comes up. So it requires work. We can't just allow for this information that we have today to make us lazy. It's an extra gift, but at the same time, it adds to the complexity, and it also makes our work in some ways a little bit harder.
So for those listening who want to learn more about Concord and also want to know what they can do, you mentioned the website, but maybe if you could mention the address again and what information is there, and maybe a couple of strong suggestions that you would have for people that want to get more involved in the issue.
Absolutely. Our website is concordcoalition.org. One thing I'll mention is we are in the process of a national fiscal wake-up tour, and we're doing that with groups to our right and left. The prominent government group is the Governmental Accountability Office that we've been working with the Comptroller General of the United States, David Walker, in several venues from Richmond, Virginia to San Diego, California, and we'll be doing several more over the next year and a half. Other organizations that have joined the Concord Coalition for this fiscal wake-up tour include the Heritage Foundation, a conservative organization, and the Brookings Institution. And so we're going and talking about some of these big challenges we face in town halls across the nation. And then there are several ways people can get involved, from writing letters to their members of Congress to sending emails to friends and colleagues. But it's part of how we do things. Our website at concordcoalition.org has a sign-up button. We invite people to join us to become a member or to receive email updates about events in their area. And then also, if people would like to contact me directly, my email is midwest@concordcoalition.org, and I welcome any comments that people have about how we can more effectively get our message out across the nation.
I appreciate that info, and I'm going to add my own personal plug to what you've said. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you're listening to Hearsay Culture, and this is Dave Levine. I've been involved with Concord. I believe I founded the first college chapter of Concord Coalition, and I can't think of an organization. At least I'm going to go so far as to say, certainly in my adult lifetime, but maybe even further, that more so has epitomized true bipartisan working together on issues. I was impressed immediately when I saw late Senator Tsongas and Senator Rudman on the Larry King show, and realized that this is an organization I wanted to be involved with. So notwithstanding the immeasurable importance of deficit reduction and maintaining true fiscal balance and sanity, which appears to be sorely lacking at the moment. Putting that issue aside, I think Concord Coalition exemplifies what I would hope the best of technology would allow, which is truly to allow people who agree on nothing else to come together on this one issue and attempt to solve problems. And it was one of the pitches that I always would make when I talk about Concord Coalition, but it was completely accurate that in New York, where I was involved, especially at the beginning, but throughout, we had members that went from literally the far right on all social issues and what have you to people who claim to still be hippies and still be involved in the peace movement, all coming together in one room and finding common interest on really what is ultimately, I think, at the end of the day, a moral question, which is what we want to pass on to our future and what we want our future to look like. And Concord Coalition, I think more than any other organization, certainly that I've been involved with, but I think I'm going to go so far as to say really, I can't think of a better one, truly exemplifies this concept of working together and putting aside these differences towards a common goal. So for anyone that's interested in these issues, but also from the academic perspective, anyone that's interested in really seeing how an organization like that truly works, I encourage you to learn more about Concord. Corey, I want to thank you for coming on today and for joining me in what's been a terrific discussion, and I hope you hear from some of my listeners.
I hope so. It's been a pleasure working with you all these years, and you know, good luck in everything, and I look forward to keeping in touch.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Corey Davison from Concord Coalition for coming on today. It's such an important issue, and it's also great to get the perspective of someone who's been involved from the beginning and who's doing an outstanding job for Concord. I've been amazed when I've worked with Corey over the last few years, how he's traveling all over the country doing this work, and he's really, I think, an incredible asset for the organization. So thank you, Corey, again, for coming on, and thank you for listening. Again, my name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. You can learn more about CIS as well as check out my blog at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And you've been listening to Hearsay Culture, which is on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on KZSU Stanford. We will be coming on next week, and the scheduled guest is Colin Rule from eBay, who will be discussing online dispute resolution, an extremely challenging and cutting-edge area in getting, in fact, very much related to the issues discussed today, which is how to get people ultimately to a common solution, a common agreement when it comes to very conflicting situations. So I'm looking forward to talking to Colin next week. So thank you again for listening, and stay tuned for your imaginary friend, and have fun the rest of the day, and maybe if you can make it over to KZSU's organizational meeting at 7, you'll be able to learn more about the station. Take care.